New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hello and welcome. I'm Emmy Vadnais, co-host with Jeffrey Mishlov. Today we'll be exploring hardcore Dharma with my guest Daniel Ingram, who is the CEO of the Emergence Benefactors that supports the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium. He was an emergency medicine physician for 12 years, primarily at major trauma centers. He is author of Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, an unusually hardcore Dharma book, and co-author of The Fire Casina with Shannon Stein. If you enjoy this program, please like, subscribe, press the bell icon, and share. Daniel is located near Huntsville, Alabama. Now I'll switch over to the internet video. Welcome, Daniel. It's a joy to have you back with me on New Thinking Aloud today.
Delightful to be here. Thank you.
The last time we spoke, we talked about emergent phenomenology, what some may experience as spiritual, mystic, or energetic experiences. It's also in the realm of parapsychology. And I'll link to that interview in the upper right corner of the screen. Today, we're going to talk about hardcore Dharma that you refer to it as that. What do you mean by that term?
The name came from the subtitle of my book, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, an unusually hardcore Dharma book. And where I got the word originally, I don't know, but this is the product of a late 20-year-old, early 30-year-old sort of gonzo type A achievement-oriented kid who was doing very intensive practice in a very hardcore way. So I think while from this older vantage point, kind of amusing and slightly absurd, also does convey something important in that a lot of us in this community were into very high dose practice, replicating old, you know, the states and stages found in old books, and really giving a go at fulfilling the old promises from the texts and traditions and even some new promises and seeing what was possible in this life, which does strike a lot of people as being pretty hardcore in terms of what we were trying for and what we were willing to do to try to achieve these things. Now, when you do that, you can cause a wide range of effects, some very positive, some very negative, and some just very weird. But that's I think some of the origin of the term. Now, it may have also come from other places, but then the community ended up being labeled sort of the pragmatic Dharma community, which is kind of like what works more than, say, necessarily following an orthodoxy, though following an orthodoxy or something like that might work. You could do that too. But it was really like pushing the edge of what people could do and what might be possible that gave us that term.
What were the promises that you were going after?
Yeah, so very explicitly, we were thinking about things like enlightenment, deep jhanas and meditative states. We were thinking about powers. We were thinking about energetic stuff, healing, traveling to other realms, exploring all of the things that were mentioned in the old text. So if you picked up, you know, the Pali canon of Theravada or some of the Vajrayana texts, which can get very interesting, or even Christian mystical books or some of the Sufi texts, which can occasionally describe very interesting ecstatic experiences, or Christian mystics, all that kind of stuff, then you find this rich world of amazing effects. And those were very compelling to me and my friends, and in particularly awakening, right, in the grand old technical sense, and seeing what might be possible and how the promises hold up or sometimes don't, and what we could do in that regard as people today.
What was the impetus for these longer, perhaps one could say deeper meditation experiences than taking it a little bit more lightly or pacing yourself?
That's another really good and important question. And I don't necessarily recommend that anybody do this. This is something to do if you're called to it in the same way as mountain climbing or skydiving or something like that, running marathons. And so in that same kind of way, some people just feel called to do those things. And there's a range of what we call the roads to power. And this comes out of old school Buddhism, but I'm going to slightly modify it. And the things that drove us were a mix of the challenge, right? Wow, somebody else could do this. Maybe we could do this too. As in, why did you climb that mountain? Because it was there. That sort of logic, which does call to some people. Burning curiosity is another one, very important. Another one was the sense of like suffering. Like people felt like something was wrong and they needed to fix something. And this maybe promised a solution. A number of us found ourselves already on the path. There was this sense of like something half-baked or that had started and wasn't completed, that we were already in some kind of way that was already unfolding. And we hoped to make it unfold in a way that was more tolerable, predictable, perhaps seemingly controllable, or if not controllable, easier to have equanimity, spaciousness, clarity, wisdom, kindness, et cetera, around. People were looking for healing. People were looking for knowledge. They wanted to know, a deep sense of that. And some people really, you know, were very kind of bodhisattva motivated. They really wanted to make a positive difference in the world and to attain to wisdom and internal transformation to be able to help others. And most of us had a mix of all of those and more at various points. But those were some of the, you know, reasons that like, oh, you can just kind of calm down and feel a little better. When we were finding these books that were promising vastly more and vastly more interesting things to us.
Do you feel that you and your friends were able to attain what you were looking for?
Some of us, yes, very much. Absolutely. So the revelation was that a lot of these experiments are replicable. What they wrote down in the old instruction manuals and promises, a lot of it you can do today. And the more of it we found that that was true for, almost the more that called to us of like, oh, can we do the rest of it? Is that also possibly true or possibly attainable, at least by some today, at some price we were willing to pay in terms of time and cost and loss of time with family or knee pain or whatever it was we were paying with. And so for those in my community, a lot of people began to realize that, in fact, they weren't just making all this weird stuff up. In fact, a lot of us who started like, okay, maybe awakening's possible, but this other weird stuff, no. Like the farther we went, the more and more we understood the perspectives of people who gave a certain ontological or at least epistemic validity to a lot of these old experiences that have been, you know, described across many, many human cultures for millennia.
Well, in a moment, I would love to hear what you and your friends got into, really, and the methods that you've used. I want to also help our viewers and listeners to understand, what does the word dharma mean?
So dharma could, or dhamma, if you want to go Pali about it, but dhamma or dharma, dharma Sanskrit, kind of the same language, just with some mechanical transformations, really. It means truth. But it could mean a lot of different types of truth. So it could mean the experience of a moment as a very direct truth, a very literal experiential truth. Like each moment could be called a dhamma or a dharma. And then you've got the sense of it being the truth of how things are. So like sensations are impermanent is sort of standardly accepted truth within Buddhism and most people's experience, I hope. If you're having permanent sensations that you have always had and will always have, let me know. But these kinds of basic essentials that seem to be, or things like a little more abstract, but kind of practical, hopefully things like the law of karma might be considered a dharma, or things like the teachings of a wisdom tradition, such as in this case, Buddhism and other traditions, that help you understand how things are. So it might not just be like the moment of how the moment is, but also statements of how moments in general and experience and reality are, but also then how you realize these truths for yourself, teachings that point to methodologies for finding those things, are the three major uses I'm familiar with, and there are probably others.
I had the great pleasure to speak with Robert Thurman, and he suggested that the goal, if you will, is to relieve suffering.
Well, it's certainly one of them, and certainly an extremely important one. As I mentioned in the Roads to Power, to relieve suffering, to heal, to reduce suffering for oneself and others, all beings, these kinds of aspirations are extremely important. And clearly, you know, I'm not a strict Buddhist in the sense of that being the only tradition that has had profound influences on me, but I certainly feel in some ways the most at home in some of the Buddhist traditions, not that I don't find uses in others as well. But the Buddha, when asked to be really succinct, when asked what he taught, would say suffering and the end of suffering. And so I think that's very valuable. But I think and from a certain point of view, that's kind of true. But the Buddha also, and lots of other wisdom traditions, teach what to me seems like vastly more than that. And maybe you could analyze each of those little things and say, yes, but really the only reason to know that is to suffer less. I'm not sure that's true. But like, there are lots of other possible goals that might be useful, or to have somebody else suffer less. And there are aesthetic considerations that aren't just necessarily quite strictly and purely about suffering. So while I, in some ways, couldn't possibly fault Robert's logic because it's sound and fundamental, particularly from a Buddhist point of view, I also think there's a richness of why we do this that is more than that. Again, is aesthetics all about suffering? I'm not quite sure it's that simple.
Well, and to be fair, he wrote a book called Wisdom is Bliss, and he even equated to that we could essentially live in an orgasmic state.
Good for him. Sounds delightful.
Yeah. I know there's a lot that you have traversed, and you do a really beautiful job in your book, The Mastering the Teachings of the Buddha, that encapsulates what you have done and you and your friends have done. I imagine those listening would love to know, what is it that you have done that has assisted you to expedite essentially what a lot of people might really be after in life?
The first thing is, my path is my path and other people's paths might be their path. So if I'm about to say this with a high degree of enthusiasm, which I think is going to happen because people tend to be enthusiastic about the things that really work for them, I want to qualify that with, please don't think I'm trying to come off as preachy or you should definitely do this or this is the right path for you. I've had a lot of friends that had very high degrees of success through a wide range of methods and emphases and styles and ways of conceptualizing and framing things. And so that's the first sort of caveat I want to give, because I can get pretty enthusiastic about these things. So what I found really exciting was A, really basic teachings, really simple lists like Eightfold Noble Path and Three Characteristics and Six Sense Doors, Three Trainings, basic stuff like that, which is kind of Theravada Buddhism and in some ways general Buddhism 101, right? And a lot of other things, traditions too. Again, I could talk on about all this other stuff in a second. So, but the thing I really personally like is incredibly simple things done in really high dose, like noticing the sensations of your breath arise and vanish as fast as you can with as much precision and clarity as you can every second for like 16 to 18 hours a day. For day after day after day. That's my idea of a good time. And I found that kind of practice, personally for me, a mix of jarring and revelatory, transformative, and sometimes harsh and edgy. So it's the path of this kind of practice isn't necessarily fun in the short or even medium or sometimes occasionally long term, but done well and with a real engagement to bring the full resolving power of your heart, mind, body system to the task at hand can be very effective in a reproducible, empirical sort of way. Empirical in really both senses of the word. Empirical in the British empiricist sense of looking into your experience as a source of, as a primary source of knowledge, like in the David Humean sense, but also empirical in the sense of a scientific experiment that if you follow these instructions found in the old books, they just happen to work, at least a non-trivial portion of the time.
just to clarify, this was, you were engaging in this practice of noticing the sensations of your breath for many hours in a day while on retreat or going about your daily activities.
And daily life too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So during my really obsessive years when I was, my hair was on fire, that explains what happened to it.
That's why a lot of Buddhists don't have hair.
That's it. That's the whole, that's actually it in a nutshell. No, back when I had hair to be on fire, every moment when I was in like the elevator going, you know, up to work, or when I was just, you know, walking to the parking lot, or I was cooking food, or I was doing something that didn't really require super precise attention, you know, just falling asleep or waking up in the morning, or, you know, brushing my teeth, you know, how many sensations and which sensations can I notice how fast and how clearly? So for me, it was very much a game of not only extremely fine-grained temporal resolution of the this side and that side of experience, trying to deconstruct the sense of a separate, stable self, but also as including as many types of sensations as I could, the intentions before actions, the mental impressions that follow phenomena, memories, anticipatory thoughts, feelings, emotions, you know, seeing, hearing, thinking, you know, all of those kinds of, you know, tasting, smelling, how many times can you smell something in 1 second? That kind of obsessiveness can seem really OCD, and in some ways it obviously is. But from another point of view, I found it very, very powerful for realizing the stuff they talked about in old books like the Abhidhamma, where they were breaking reality down into this very fine-grained moments of mind and types of experience, and seeing, okay, if they could see that 2,500 years ago, or 2,300 or 2,000 or however long, old you think the Abhidhamma is, can I see that? Can I perceive that? Can I feel that, hear that, smell that, taste that, see thoughts with that high degree of not only temporal resolution, but also inclusiveness of not only just the foreground, but also the background and the space in between. And so that sort of technical, you might say I came up in the path of technical craft, obsessive technical craft maybe, which is definitely not everybody's cup of tea. I mean, a lot of you are probably sitting there thinking, yeah, what about heart-centered practice? Or what about kindness? Well, I did a bunch of loving kindness and stuff too. What about social practices? Sure, I tried those in my geeky way. And, you know, bodily practices. Sure, I did some yoga and other things like that, and exercise and mindful walking. But it was the bare sensate perception of the three characteristics that was really my obsession for a lot of my path.
And can you break those down for us?
Six sense doors, three characteristics. So impermanent suffering and no self. So noticing each sensation arises and vanishes totally, like utterly gone. And then these things happen on their own, and they all know themselves where they are, rather than being the result of a separate stable agent or doer, or the cognitive stimulus for the knowledge of a central knower. So instead, noticing every sensation arises where it is, does what it does on its own, extremely quickly, in a way that is impermanent in both a digital and an analog sense, and to be able to see both of those. And then suffering, and then to notice that is, if you make even the most subtle dualistic anything out of any pattern of sensations, there is a grating fundamental tension in that that can be resolved, in my case, layer by layer.
How long before you started to receive results or experience benefits of this practice?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. So I'm one of these weird kids who I was able to get in some really blissful and peaceful states when I was 3 and 4 years old. So I was a young kid and I could do relaxation stuff. I would later come to think of using terminology such as jhanic factors or jhanas, which are states of calm, peace, bliss, etc., that are found in technical Buddhism. And again, there's a lot of debate about how people use those words and what constitutes a jhana, but these things I could get into when I was very young had some relationship to jhanic practice, felt very straightforward to me. And they started to arise, I lost the ability for over 2 decades, and then they started to arise on retreat as these very powerful factors that I was like, oh, I know that one. I had that when I was a really young kid. So, and it turns out if you actually really carefully ask questions of people, including sometimes people's own children, and they won't even know it because nobody bothered to ask them, about, like, you know, kids or people about their childhoods. It's not uncommon for people to report these sorts of experiences when they were really young, or at least some of them, and to have had some kind of taste of something. And so I was actually quite young when I started having some benefit from what I didn't even know was practice, but it turns out was. And then I was about 14 or 15 years old when, trying to have better flying dreams and attempting to visualize flying, I had my first major explosion of consciousness, my first time traveling out of body. And then I started having weird energetic and other bizarre mood and perceptual stuff that happened for about 10 years in a semi-cyclic fashion that I really had very little understanding of, until I ran into technical Buddhist meditators and started going on retreats and started having these experiences very reproducibly in incredibly condensed time frames. That, you know, maybe something that had unfolded over, you know, a few years started happening in days on retreat or weeks. And so I was like, hey, I know this pattern, but now it's got this periodicity and this predictableness to it. Like each retreat would have kind of an arc of ups and downs. And okay, now I'm starting to recognize that. And then on my fourth retreat, I was introduced to the maps. And the maps in this case were in a little book called Practical Insight Meditation by Mahasi Sayadaw, and later the Visuddhimagga and the Vimuttimagga and the Abhidhamma. And then once I realized there were maps of this stuff that seemed to be freakishly applicable to my own practice with levels of detail I could never have imagined, of like explaining all this weird stuff that had been happening to me for my life up to that point, I was off and running, trying to figure out, well, where do these things lead? What do they do? What can you do with these? And that became part of my obsession.
I believe you share in your book that, to your point, that you were able to have these blissful experiences as a child. And, you know, there's even a phrase, a question of, what is your most happy childhood memory? And so people can have these different experiences at different points in their lives. And for some people, they might need to, or could meditate or other practices to help them achieve that, but it seems like it's not necessarily linear in that development.
Definitely not. And why I lost the ability after about age 4, and I know this by where we lived, because we moved around a lot when I was a kid, so I can time stamp things pretty well in terms of the age I was. Why I lost those abilities, I don't know. The path is definitely nonlinear. I know plenty of people who have gained and lost various abilities along the way for various periods of time, some never to return. So it is a strange thing. The maps at least partially explain some of that, but certainly not all of it. And again, these maps have been, you know, people just noticing the patterns of practice and describing them, sometimes through semi-orthodox lenses, but some of them very, very technical and descriptive and nuanced in the same way that like an anatomy or embryology textbook might be. And so, at least for me, I found that the maps did have a lot of explanatory power. And again, they do predict some point where like you may have all these cool stuff and then it all fades away. It's not uncommon for people. And my guess is some of you in the audience, if you're interested in these sorts of topics, at some point probably had what like Abraham Maslow would call a peak experience, as well as a lot of the transpersonal kids would. And I would probably call something like the arising and passing away. And somebody else might call like a Kundalini opening or a conversion experience, or pick your initiatory experience, or knowledge and conversations of one's holy guardian angel if you're in a Western magical tradition or something like that. But if you've had one of those experiences, that makes it way more likely you'll be into this stuff. And a lot of the maps predict that after something like that, a lot of the stuff will fade and you will enter in something of a dark night, as St. John of the Cross and the Carmelite mystics called it. And knowledge is a suffering, as Buddhism calls it, and various other things, as various other traditions label them. And where you will lose a lot of the spark, the joy, the access, the sense of connection, the magic, the whatever it was.
Could you tell us what a jhana, or is it jhana? Jhana? How do you say it, Daniel?
So there's jhanas, J-H-A-N-A, or if you're being Sanskrit about it, dhyana, D-Y-A-N-A. And so jhana is the Pali. And then there's jnanas, which is N with a tilde, or N-Y. A-N-A, so which are knowledges. And so these are various maps. So if you're getting deeper into what's called samatha or samadhi practice, where you're deepening your concentration and intentionally excluding hindrances and including blissful, peaceful, tranquil, equanimous, formless, et cetera, experiences, then you go through what are called the jhanas. And in classical Buddhism, there are eight or so of them. And so basically you start out with, like, just as a quick rundown of basic Theravada and jhana theory. In the first jhana, you have applied and sustained focus or effort or attention, however you want to translate it. And that secludes your mind from the hindrances. And so with a strongly concentrated mind secluded from the hindrances, you have bliss and rapture and, a happy mind, basically. And so, and then as the state becomes more effortless and it takes less sort of, holding the mind there and vitaka and vichara, which are these words that you could think of as like aiming and rubbing or something, the mind on the object. When things start to show themselves more naturally, the rapturous qualities and the blissful qualities can become stronger, and the mind can have a very bright center of attention and can be very clear, stable. And then as even the more pleasurable sensations, eventually one can find them sort of jarring in the sense of, like, how long does anybody want to have a super pleasurable experience? You know, eventually you can become sort of a divine apathy towards these kinds of things. And then there's sort of a wide, cool tranquility that can set in. And then eventually that cool, subtly blissful tranquility can shift to a wide open, expansive, kind of flowy equanimity, and with a sense of kind of a natural but not forced mindfulness to it. So these are, you know, one simple way of explaining the jhanas.
You mentioned maps.
Yep.
I would love for you to share your thoughts about these maps, because in your book, you suggest that these are predictable in how a person might experience these, and that maybe not everybody agrees with you necessarily.
Yeah. So the first thing is the maps worked really pretty darn well, with a few exceptions for me. So that predisposes me as a person sitting here postulating on their sense of how the world is. It introduces a certain form of bias. Now, once you have this form of bias, it's possible that you fit everything into that kind of a box and see everything through that kind of a lens, which admittedly might be true. That said, I'm something of a frantic and fanatic student of maps, and I have probably 100 books on this much bigger than you can see set of shelves behind me that are some sort of a map of this kind of territory through the lens of some kind of tradition. I became a fanatical student of the maps and reading quite widely, basically every single thing I could possibly find on them from every tradition I could find, and comparing and correlating them, and sort of found myself kind of doing like a PhD for myself of what are the maps and what are they like and what do people say about them, kind of that amount of reading and thought and synthesis. And while you do see differences, there are also some clear patterns that to me just stand out. And having been on a bunch of retreats and taught a bunch of different people on retreats, particularly when people do intensive practices, and particularly certain ones, it is very common to notice very stock and standard patterns of the way people move through this. And you'll see whole groups kind of going through this, even if they don't know what is happening with the other person, because it's a silent retreat and they're not talking to anybody, that kind of thing. And having talked to literally thousands of people about their adventures, there's almost nobody who I didn't recognize at least substantial pieces and parts of the maps, even if they had unique or seemingly unique and interesting variants with their own personal takes and quirks. And the maps can be complicated. So things can unfold in different orders, and depending on the emphasis of what sense store you're preferencing, things can look very different. But one way or another, I have come to believe that the maps can lend a tremendous amount of normalization for people going through what to them might just be baffling or weird, or think nobody else could possibly have gone through something like this. It can be very, very helpful for a lot of people, although there are people who really do like to feel super special and they don't like being told that maybe someone else had an experience kind of like they had. So you do run into that sometimes. Although there are some people who, even when the patterns seems like a strangely good fit from my point of view, they read and look at the stuff and they go, no, 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 that's not my experience at all. Even if lots of the elements to me seem like, oh, of course this is, but so you get these sort of stylistic and interpretive disagreements, which are just par for the course and normal, I think, in any sort of human discourse.
Mm-hmm. And someone may also be wondering, how long will this particular stage last?
Yeah, and that is highly unpredictable. So while it is true that on retreats, things are more predictable, that is also, they're incredibly wide and long tails on this. And it's also very much a fractal kind of thing where you've got like little cycles within bigger cycles, within much bigger cycles. So cycles that might take fractions of a second, cycles that might take minutes to hours, cycles that might just sort of apply to a single sit or practice session, cycles that might play, you know, apply to the arc of a day, particularly when on retreat, cycles that might apply to the arc, the general arc of the days on that retreat, bigger cycles over like months or years that might be modulating what's happening on that retreat. And then you've got a whole lot of variance and the way people, and then the range of intensity, not just the duration, but also the range of intensity. So even some like peak experiences, which you would think, you know, would generally be pretty impressive, for sometimes through them, when I went through and would recognize, oh, that was that stage, it was really subtle. And other times it was fireworks and explosions and wild openings. Even if functionally from a map point of view, later on, I would look back and go, okay, that functionally was the same stage, even if it was very gentle or subtle or quick or quiet or non-dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, curiously enough, some of the most important stages are the very non-dramatic ones, generally.
What else stands out to you about these maps and these experiences that you've had and the patterns you've seen with your friends and colleagues who have engaged in this hardcore Dharma practice?
Yeah, so the big overarching pattern is, I'm going to just kind of lay out the stages of insight. And I'll do it in a really quick summary fashion, recognizing that what I'm about to say is incredibly simplistic. This is something I've literally talked for 6 hours on one time and didn't say anything like all the stuff that could be said about it. So stage one, you can see thoughts as thoughts, basically. That's a revelation for some people. They've always thought of their thoughts as them. They've been caught in them, totally contracted and identified into them. And to be able to see a thought come and go is game changing. This is like what mindfulness makes, just takes and does incredible horizontal or lateral work, as I call with it. They're not trying to move past that, but necessarily. Well, it's a whole nother story. But they take that insight and work it for all it's worth. Very impressive, very useful psychologically to have some space around your intentions, your actions, what you're about to say, what you're feelings, to be able to say, oh, that's just a story in my head that's on a loop, and you're not totally like caught in it. Game changing, like mental health major upgrade.
Yeah, because you're able to step back from your thoughts and observe them without either getting caught up in them, or maybe even you can notice the ways perhaps that you judge yourself or judge others, and to realize that you aren't necessarily your thoughts per se.
There you go. So that's bringing up a next point of it's not just the recognition, but also an existential implication of who you are and who you aren't. We're getting there because that's an important thing.
Yes.
Right. But yes. So, and then the next thing is something called cause and effect. If any of you out there have ever meditated and found you were kind of messing, like paying attention to the breath, and you were kind of messing the breath up, like the intention to pay attention to it was somehow interfering with it, making it feel unnatural or forced or kind of something weird. That's a stage called cause and effect. And that's where you can begin to see this curious thing that happens between attention and phenomena in this very kind of almost mechanical sort of a way. I'm not going to dwell on that one, but it's a very interesting topic. The next one is a stage we call three characteristics. Tends to involve asymmetrical muscle tension. This is like day two or three on a retreat where you see everybody shifting posture and building their nest and suddenly doing yoga and trying to figure out why their body hurts so much, and their knees and their back and their neck and their jaw. And like they're sitting like this and they think their posture is straight. And, you know, you see also, anyway, three characteristic stage. If you ever run into that one, you may have, and it can happen in daily life too. So a lot of spasmodic torticollis and weird, you know, and it can feel very much like energy is kind of stuck or like an emotional body armor thing. Like massage therapists get a lot of business out of this one. So as do trauma people, right? Because then the next thing is when that starts to move, the energy feels like it starts to move, you get into the next stage. The next stage is called the arising and passing away, or the A and P, as I tend to shorthand it. And the A and P is one of the most important stages on the path. And I'm going to talk about it in very dramatic terms, recognizing that it can be very subtle. So it can be really a delicate, quick little thing, but sometimes it can go boom. Basically, if you've ever heard any say, like, this meditation thing blew my doors off, use the word orgasmic. Anything about vortexes, energy, chakras, explosions, bright lights, raptures, body trembling, spontaneous openings of powers, nearly all of that I'm going to throw in that stage. It's a huge topic, but the essence of it is, look, the mind has gotten much faster, much higher resolution. A lot of positive factors have come on board, of equanimity, of mindfulness, of energy, of concentration. It's like, whoa, I can meditate. This is exciting. A lot of positive factors can start coming on board, in a high degree of mindfulness, concentration, increased ability to sit for a long time, reduced pain, increased high resolution precision of mind, perception of vibrations, which is arising and passing away, means that your ability to perceive individual sensations in the center of attention arise and pass away. And it's an extremely powerful time that, again, I could talk about for hours in all its variants. But my guess is some non-trivial portion of the audience has had this sort of thing happen to them, or you wouldn't be interested in these topics. It's also kind of a point of no return. It's like the beginning of spiritual adolescence. It's a thing that happened to me at around 14 or 15 when my consciousness went boom. And it can happen on psychedelics. It can happen on a wide range of circumstances. It can happen in childbirth. It can happen for no particularly obvious reason. It can happen certainly on intensive meditation retreats, and some techniques seem to be particularly good for getting people through the stuff. Kundalini yoga and all of that are specifically designed to do this. So anyway, so you go up, usually, although for some people it can be scary and jarring, and the movements and the raptures and the stuff can be very not what they were expecting. And like, consciousness exploding is not always that fun. So that's the A and P. And then the next stages kind of come as a package, as we say, and they're called the knowledges of suffering. And there's map 5 through 10 in this model: dissolution, fear, misery, disgust, desire for deliverance, and a mildly named one called reobservation that actually is the hardest of them all. And then if you get through all of these in some kind of way, then equanimity, which is this open, expansive, spacious, peaceful, everything's fine. What was the big deal? It's not particularly like high drama in any direction. It can feel quite wonderful and clean and clear, or just super ordinary. And then after that, formal stages of awakening. So that basic kind of pattern, I just see again and again and again and again and again in people, which has made me something of a rough clinical perennialist. Where I think there's a lot of human variation of technique and upbringing and everything, but there's also something about the way our minds work and process reality that often, though not in everybody, can go through these. And then there are people who are weirdly insight resistant. Like, why is it that some people who practice years of retreat time and it's all psychology and back pain and they never got into any of this stuff? They may have never even seen mind and body. They never really saw thoughts as thoughts, and they certainly didn't get to any of the energetics or the dark nighty stuff. And then other people, like the wind blows when they're like 3 and they're off and running in this territory. Who knows? We don't really understand that, but I would love to study it as a scientist. So something in that map, another person reached out to me today, was a person in a graduate program and a PhD program who was talking about their adventures in this territory that was very poorly understood by the clinical mainstream. And when what they were describing to me sounds exactly like the stuff you would be, you know, thumbs up on an insight meditation retreat in a context of normalization and support, but in the context of Western psychiatry and parents who didn't want anything weird happening to their child and forced medications and hospitalizations and all that, was less salutary than they would have wished it to be. So the EPRC then is trying to figure out how some version of appreciating these patterns, which have been described across many, many traditions, can usefully inform the clinical mainstream in terms of the the perils, but also the promises for transformation, healing, growth, perceptual upgrades, emotional resilience, psychological well-being, and an increased ability to do something useful in the world, hopefully, which I think are dramatically underappreciated in the Western mainstream. So while the maps can cause a lot of wonderful effects, such as normalization, description, prediction, prescription for how to deal with challenging or confusing or interesting things, as well as taking advantage of opportunities that may be presented at each stage for exploration or healing or growth or something, the maps can also cause all kinds of problems, the big ones being scripting, competition, false claims of attainments, undercalling attainments, comparison, judgment, and all of the standard problems that you run into with any sort of gamified thing where there are layers and levels and all of that. And so there's certainly something of a learning curve in terms of how to relate to them with some degree of maturity that hopefully mitigates and avoids their problems while taking advantage of their opportunities.
At this point, there may be people thinking, how lengthy of a process is this before I can start experiencing benefits?
It's incredibly variable with people who spend tons of time doing these things and honestly don't get a lot other than some very basic skills of attention control, hopefully, and dealing with their stuff and their bodies. And then there are others who, in strangely small doses, have remarkable effects and everything in between. So, and then this is not linear at all. So there are people who nothing, and then huge breakthroughs. And then there are other people who they get some cool stuff and then not much. And then there are some for whom this is extremely difficult at periods and then really easy at other places and the reverse, really easy and then super difficult. And some for whom just not a lot's going on, but they're kind of okay. So you see this wide range, and that was described back in the day, and you see it today as well.
When you speak of maps, are we really talking about maps of consciousness?
We're certainly talking about maps of experience, and we're certainly talking about maps of energetic effects, and we're certainly talking about maps of various emotional effects, sometimes movement effects, perceptual effects, existential effects. These maps also predict things around volition and conation, which is related to goals, and they predict various social effects. And so a wide range of those kinds of effects, the degree to which they have anything to do with what consciousness is or questions like that is highly debated. They can certainly produce a wide range of what I would call noetic effects, which is a sense of a deep knowing that what you are experiencing or your interpretation of that experience is somehow very true. So the sense of, this is it, this is the thing, I have understood, eureka, that kind of vibe. But that doesn't necessarily mean it is true, just that the experience of deep truth can arise. So I want to have a little bit of epistemic humility and agnosticism of the degree to which those might occur. Particularly as some of these deep noetic experiences may be deeply contradictory, like all is divine love and all is, empty void, are not quite the same deep truth. And yet people can experience both of those with equally compelling force, and sometimes together and sometimes in strangely short amounts of time. And so the question of how this answers anything about the great existential questions or ontological questions is anyone's guess.
So it sounds like you're suggesting that the deeper truth isn't necessarily all divine love or all nothingness. So what have you discovered to be a deeper truth?
All sensations are impermanent. They seem to arise in a causal fashion that is largely incomprehensible. Everything seems to know itself where it is and happen as it does. This sounds weirdly straightforward. Beyond these sorts of basic empirical truths, I'm kind of a funny one that I've had, other than a full-on near-death experience while I was being coded, I've kind of had all the experiences, which is sort of a ridiculous thing to say. And a number of them, I've had them a whole bunch of times. And nearly all of them were incredibly compelling. And if they had grouped in one sort of neighborhood of experiences that were all kind of the same, it would be nearly impossible not to hold those as the truth. But as I hinted at earlier, when you've had like the experience that all is divine love and all is meaningless emptiness and all is void and all is pure energy, and I have existed across countless thousands of lives and there is no center point to exist or be reborn that withstands any scrutiny. After you've had a number of those experiences, all of which were fantastically compelling for some period, and they can't all possibly be true in some sort of way that makes much logical sense, you begin to sort of get the joke, and or at least I have, and now I hold all of these experiences and the interpretations that arise from them quite lightly, and find them useful sometimes in conversing with various people or for normalizing certain things that people might experience. But ultimately, other than things change, appear here, are occurring now, are transient, that this very, very basics that sound utterly mundane and yet are actually really important, that no sensations can grasp any other sensations and fix or freeze them in any true sense of the word. Those ended up being some of the most important truths that I came to.
Many people embark on these paths to attain what some refer to as enlightenment or being able to be in a place of non-suffering. Some may refer to that as nirvana or bliss. Are you in that camp?
So as you may have noticed from the cover of my book and the controversy that swirls around me online, I definitely make pretty high claims to attainment and have for almost 21 years now. We're getting up on 21 since that last flip of major consequence occurred. And so how do I describe this? So you certainly, I am certainly willing to use words like Nibbana, recognizing that Nibbana has a lot of hype around it. When you actually look at how it held up in the old days, like even the Buddha got headaches and back pain and sometimes got so irritated with the Sangha that he would, you know, wander off and leave them to retreat on their own because he was so fed up with them and you know, ended up dying in a state of agony from whatever abdominal malady was afflicting him. And despite all of his jhanic and meditative abilities. And if you really look at the books like The Great Disciples of the Buddha, which talk about the stories of these people and what it was like when they got old and sick and were dying or unwell, or you recognize that there's a very strange thing that happens with realization is on the one hand, when all phenomena understand themselves where they are and are kind of synchronized with themselves and there's no separate sense of an attention anywhere that is a true doer, knower, controller, beer, stable entity, which is how I describe an experience life and have for a little over two decades now, there is something really nice about that. It is definitely better than the other way of experiencing reality, where reality is trying to take all these impermanent sensations and make a separate doer, knower, controller, beer somewhere in the center of it, or trying to fix or freeze luminous space as a grand, you know, foundation of being or cosmic consciousness or whatever. So this way of perceiving reality is better, and it does a number of interesting things when it comes to basic things like bliss, pleasure, pain, etc. So you could say there is something blissful about synchrony or clear perception when it's really fully locked in or not trying to lock anything in is the better way to say it. And then that's true. But then there's also a high clarity that comes with that. So every little pain is experienced clearly as pain. There's still unpleasant sensations and human conflicts and other things that roll through. I just got over something of an intestinal malady, and it was not pleasant sitting there shaking with fever and having muscle aches and cramps and all kinds of things. It was distinctly dysphoric, to put it gently. And while my experience of it might have been nicer than had I not had some kind of insights, on the other hand, that doesn't take away from the fact of raw human experience sometimes being distinctly unpleasant. As many people have noticed, like the really common one you see is when they start, you know, if people with some degree of insight get cancer and they describe going through chemotherapy, pretty much all of them say this sucks. I was just reading a thing by Christopher Titmus that he had sent out in his emails. And, you know, chemotherapy is awful, like usually, you know, cancer is awful. There are things that await us that may be really challenging whatever we understand about life. And so both are true. That also said, there is a proportionality to experience where a pain is no bigger than it otherwise might appear to be. So that, you know, if a pain is this big and, you know, is only there so often and, you know, has only this degree of intensity, the mind isn't making it more than that, like the mind tended to do before. And so there is something in that, in the proportionality and the natural recognition that most of what's occurring in space is fine. But that doesn't negate any of the clear perception of the unpleasant aspects of life, of the consequences of having been born into this human body.
What was the consequence you mentioned 21 years ago?
Oh, 21 years ago is when I was on retreat and the thing flipped over and stayed flipped over into the clear perception of everything, just being where it is, doing what it does, utterly transient, utterly immediate, knowing itself where it is all the way through without any exception anywhere to be found anymore. So that's how I sort of phenomenologically describe whatever happened to me. And you can debate what words we might use for that, but that's the phenomenological description.
And since there are the arising and passing away experiences, and much of what we experience, one could say, dissolves, and you also say in your book, we are not our mind or our body, then what are we and what can we hold on to, if anything?
So from a Buddhist and my own experiential point of view, trying to hold on to anything in that sense of perceptual stability to make a place where we land, where we are, is part of the problem. And this is why realization can be a tricky thing, because that is not intuitive. Existentially, there is very much something that's like, oh, you know, trying to not have just the groundlessness, the true ephemerality and transience, the utter ungraspability. And so for a lot of us, like me, it took a lot of work to try to unstick that habit. And some people get it much more easily than I did. I had to use all kinds of fancy methods and intense techniques and a lot of theory and careful investigation. But so in terms of the sense of a stable place that is a centralized knowing, doing, controlling self, you can't actually find one. Psychologically, existentially, that's definitely something of an acquired taste. And the layers of that unfolding in practice can also be something of an acquired taste, to put it gently. Not everybody likes this process.
So how do you relate to yourself or your non-self now than you did over 20 years ago?
So there are a lot of fronts on which one might look and try to answer that question. And I'll start with the most ordinary. From a very ordinary point of view, I'm still Daniel talking to you, sitting here on a couch in front of a camera with a microphone and headphones and all of that. And so that kind of ordinary interpretation and parsing of reality is still very much there. You know, I pay bills, I'm in a marriage, I have a family, all of the ordinary stuff, that way of perceiving reality. And this is going to bring us into the three trainings, which we were going to talk about. You had mentioned morality earlier, and I'm kind of wrapping back to that one. So Buddhism is traditionally divided into three trainings, each of which have very different assumptions about reality. And the first training is sila or shila, and it means something like ethics or ethical body, speech, and mind action, or living wisely in the ordinary world in a way that hopefully reduces suffering and increases happiness. And if that first training very much assumes a self, it assumes an agent, it assumes time, it assumes a past and a future, it assumes a Daniel that 5 seconds later is still a Daniel, it assumes a you that is still a you and all of you in the audience. So it makes very ordinary assumptions about reality. And then it says, in an ordinary way, using these ordinary assumptions, we should use ordinary skillful actions of body, speech, and mind to live skillfully in the world. From a psychological point of view, obviously, I can still say, oh, I have issues, or I was, talking to my dad and we were reminiscing and about his stories, and use I in a totally ordinary sort of a way. Again, with the assumption being that there is time, past, present, future, and that all of those have some functional validity from an ordinary working point of view. So that's one way of looking at reality. And with regard to that, in a lot of ways, I seem to be relatively ordinary, nothing particularly special. And then from a second training point of view, the second training is a little different. And that's the one we were talking about earlier with regard to jhanas or dhyanas. And the second training is about very special states of mind. It's about excluding qualities of mind we don't want. It's about including qualities of mind we want. And it's about learning how to tune the sort of attention and experiential control levers of the mind in very precise ways to train the mind to be able to get into very skillful states. So it's kind of a very refined and specialized skill set in some ways, though it can have implications for psychology and also can help support the last training. But then you have this last training of wisdom, and its assumptions are totally different. There's only now, and now is totally transient. Everything is utterly ephemeral. None of these sensations imply any I or self or true doer, knower, controller, beer in the deep existential perceptual sense. And it's actually possible through these techniques to have the entire way that reality is both perceived and interpreted to flip over, and everything's just happening where it is, knowing itself as it does all the way through for everything. And again, that generally happens in stages. And with regard to that point of view, it is very nice to notice the direct experience of thought as an intrinsic part of just this field of stuff happening. So that does have psychological implications, like the fact of any thought occurring is just a wispy little thing, like barely noticeable in terms of its colors and textures and how loud the sound of it is in comparison to, say, the lights or the camera or the room or the couch or the laptop, any of those things. And so that provides a lot of space around thought. It's not quite the same as no thought, but it's like 99% of the way there, which is really cool, because like what percentage of your experience of the room, for example, is the colors and textures and sound of your thoughts? Not even a percent in terms of the strength of them. And having that kind of baked in to perception really does give a lot of space and ability to have a sense of humor at the absurd things that thought thinks, and to have some looseness around these kinds of things. And that's nice. And it also does change some very fundamental existential emotional something around questions of life, death, being, grasping, some of those things. Although they're not as easy to define as they typically seem to be in the old texts, which from my point of view kind of simplify and dumb down what actually happens.
How do you relate to your life now compared to before you got on this hardcore Dharma path?
Let's see here. The first thing is I found it vastly more meaningful. To have a quest was meaningful. To have fulfilled a quest was also meaningful, and also experientially just provided real upgrades. So it was a fruitful quest, a valuable quest, a quest that was what I was looking for. And that sense of having satisfied the insight element, a lot of people, and me included, while I was sort of crashing around on this path, can feel very called out. I was called out to go on retreats. I was called out to sacrifice vacation time. I was called out to not watch TV. I was called out to basically give up playing music most of the time. I was called out to have very limited friend circles. There was a lot of being called out to do something that seems special and important and very relevant and interesting, fascinating even, and sometimes rewarding, if sometimes very challenging. But that was, so that was one phase. And then 21 years ago, when the thing flipped over, the only thing that was left was the specifics, the details, the other two trainings. And so how to live an ordinary life free from the quest to find some ultimate truth that is other than this moment, that also did was sort of the ultimate calling in, if that's the ultimate of being called out, because suddenly everything is it all the way through. There's no other, you know, thing to be found. There's no future in which there is a realization that's different from this. And so the only thing that was relevant is the experience of this moment, cleanly and clearly in a life well lived now. And that galvanized a tremendous amount of energy that previously had been dedicated to the quest to do useful things like, you know, continue my medical education and to, you know, help people philanthropically and to volunteer with the projects I now volunteer on and try to make a positive difference in this world. When aesthetics are all that is the only thing going on now, all of the energy can be dedicated to that. And that's really nice.
Yeah. You're able to be very much in the present moment.
It's not able to be very, like, was there really ever another option? So part of realization is recognizing there wasn't actually another option, but we can imagine there is. Even when we think, oh, I'm not really in the present moment, well, that thought is in the present. Or if there was a moment when attention wasn't that clear or focused or seemed lost in thought, even the direct experience of being lost in thought is a direct, clear experience. So, but recognizing that obviously is somehow transformative and better.
The awareness of being in the present moment.
Yes.
Do you like that better?
It's a recognition, really. It's a remembering. It's something like that.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it took a lot of discipline.
Yes. My particular path did. That's true. A lot of renunciation, a lot of discipline, a lot of hard work. But that's not true for everyone. Some people do better in the path of service or with, path of love or the path of whatever, community. I did a lot of hard cushion hours. Okay.
A part of Buddhism is non-attachment. At the same time, it sounds like there are states of consciousness that you prefer and are able to call up on demand.
Yes. And that's why I continue to, you know, find myself in scanners and with wires on my head and EEG and stuff. Yes.
How do you resolve that non-attachment with some attachment, it seems, perhaps?
Well, there are two different meanings of attachment. So there's attachment in the sense of ordinary preferences. So to prefer pleasant states of mind or peaceful states of mind to unpleasant and unpeaceful states of mind or body or emotion or whatever is hardly a surprise. And even if you know people who have, you know, various degrees of awakening, you still find the same thing. That said, I'm guessing the Dalai Lama has his favorite food, for example, you know, or like prefers his robes clean to dirty or, those kinds of things. And prefers to be healthy rather than not healthy, you know. And so preferences arise naturally as part of what the universe does. They are causal and they are ungraspable. They are unstoppable. They are a natural part of an unfolding of the universe. And it is that recognition of the ungraspability and the naturalness that is the deeper meaning of attachment. So non-attachment, meaning the mind is not constantly perceptually attempting to go, that is a thing that I can hold to. The mind isn't doing that anymore. It's like everything moving through space perfectly easily without resistance, including space, because it would be like imagine if these sensations of finger thought they could grasp these sensations of air or something like and fix and freeze them or hold them. Well, that's obviously sort of a ridiculous notion, but the sensations that this, you know, the notion that the sensations of our eyes or face or sinuses or chest or heart could grasp or fix or freeze a momentary fleeting thought of ourselves as an identity is equally ludicrous. And yet we spend, you know, substantial portion of our lives often believing at a very deep perceptual and interpretive level that that is what is true.
Mm-hmm.
So when that stops, that there's something really nice about that.
Yeah. You're able to be more in the flow and resilient.
That is definitely true. More in it, like utterly in it. It's not just more. It's a total in the thing because the whole thing is doing itself. But again, it's a recognition of that. The whole thing was always just flowing with itself, even with its confusion or its attempts to grasp. Those were just things that were part of the natural flow and unfolding of the universe.
Yeah, it's already there. We're already there.
It's already occurring.
You mentioned that you sometimes are hooked up to EEG machines. Can you share a little bit about why you have had those experiences?
Of being studied in neuroscience? Sure. So my friends Willoughby Britton and Judd Brewer, some 10 years ago or so, maybe a little over, brought me up to Yale to study me in fMRI because I claimed to have some attention regulation abilities that were strong, and they wanted to see if that might be true. So they put me in a scanner and got me doing various tasks. This is an fMRI, and got to see, like, hey, can this person actually regulate their attention the way they say they can, at least in a scanner? And can we measure that to some degree? And they were measuring something called the posterior cingulate. And the cool thing about that study was I actually got to see about 8-second delayed feedback of when I shifted into various attention modes or did things with my mind and experience. I could get to see what it did in terms of increasing or decreasing the blood flow to a particular region of my brain. And that was pretty neat. And got to see, hey, this is seems to be what the PCC does when I shift attention this way or tune it that way. It seems to get more or less deactivated. And the PCC, or posterior cingulate, is part of what's called the default mode network. And its job is regulating attention and in various specific ways. What I think it is, just or at least in me, it seems to be the switch that tunes in or out this space. So if people are like, huh, what's on my calendar next Thursday? When they do that, they're usually their eyes go up to one side and they're activating the PCC. And that takes the sensory information of ordinary sight, sound, body, kind of dampens those down and allows thoughts, which are super wispy things, to become much stronger. So you can see what's on your calendar next Thursday or something. And so that's what I think the PCC does, and at least in my experience. And then when they were but the problem is an fMRI is $1 million toy. So if you're trying to figure out how to teach people to regulate their PCC and regulate their default mode network and be able to, you know, tune in or tune out and have a metacognitive capacity about that, you want to do that with a cheaper device. And so Judd then had me come up to Yale and then UMass a few times to test out a beamforming algorithm where they basically put, you know, have an $80,000 toy rather than a few $1 million toy. And then can you figure out how to image the PCC, which is kind of in the middle of the brain. So not that good for EEG, but they, with fancy beamforming algorithms, you can do it and say, hey, can we image this thing in a way that's, you know, still expensive, but much cheaper? And so I got to help them test some of those algorithms, and it turns out you can. And then the goal of that was to create a commercial product that, you know, that's not what ended up actually happening. And then what I did learn through that process is that with wires on my head and under pressure and in a, you know, 130 decibel shaking fMRI, I can do some cool meditative tricks. And then that led eventually to further neuroscience studies at Harvard and then Vanderbilt and now Imperial College London, and hopefully some others at some point.
Well, I would love to have more conversations with you about the research studies where you have been a subject, a participant, and also that you have conducted yourself as well.
Yeah, so I did buy a little research, low-end research grade Cognionics Quick 20R, and we've actually got a paper that's come out. So if you look at, there's a paper out of Harvard on cessation. So EEG study of cessation. And you can find that one online if you look for it. It just recently came out. I'm very thankful for all of the team and all the people who helped work on that and help with the data analysis and did some fancy analysis that was beyond my abilities. And we're starting to demonstrate that some of these insight stages may have very particular signatures that you can see on EEG, which is cool because for years people have been like, oh, is this real? And do people actually do that? And how do you know? We can't really trust anybody. Maybe soon enough, you kind of maybe can. We'll see. Still very early days, but that's what it's looking like, at least for a few of these.
And an EEG is an electroencephalogram that measures the brain waves or that may be correlated to different states of consciousness.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. For those listening who are very inspired or somewhat inspired or inspired enough who want to either begin their own meditation practice, where do you suggest they begin? Or maybe they already have a practice and they've been maybe kind of on and off with it. What kind of tips or suggestions do you have for them?
That actually typically is a very long conversation because I don't have anything like a one-size-fits-all approach, nor do I necessarily think there even should be such a thing. Usually it begins with a discussion of goals and aesthetics, of what people have tried, of what they liked about it and what they didn't, of what they're trying to do, and then really what they're trying to do, and then really what they're trying to do. I can't tell you the number of people I talk to who initially is like, I want to gain enlightenment. Okay, great. Why do you want to do that? Because I want to wake up. Okay, great. Why do you want to do that? And if you ask like three or four more questions, it's because like I'm having a lot of fights with my boyfriend or girlfriend and I want us to be able to get along better. And then like maybe that deserves its own attention on its own terms and you shouldn't necessarily assume that enlightenment is necessarily going to fix that. And so usually questions of goals, of resources, like do you have, you know, 2.3 kids and 1.5 jobs and, you know, aging parents or whatever? Or are you like some trust fund kid who could wander off to Asia for a year and crash around and have your life potentially be somewhat destabilized for a while and you'd likely be fine, hopefully. And so, or, you know, what's your kind of underlying baseline level of mental health coming into this or physical health? What are your obligations in this world? And what really calls to you? Like some people really like the austerity and kind of mapless mystery of Zen, and other people like, you know, the technical beauty of the Theravada, and some people really like fancy hats, in which case the Tibetans got it going on, you know, or Catholicism has some really good hats too. So like, you know, I don't mean to rag on those traditions, fine, interesting traditions. Sorry, being a little flip here, but you know what I mean. And so it's usually a discussion around those kinds of things. And like, what's really calling to them and what are they willing to do for it? And again, what risks are they going to take? Because, you know, the higher dose, the more intensity, generally the higher risk, like mountain climbing or skydiving.
Now, you took a hardcore path where you went on lots of retreats, meditated for many hours a day. For those who don't feel they either have the time or want to commit to that or have the resources, is it attainable for them to reach some of these levels while they're working their jobs, maybe taking care of children or aging parents or whatever kinds of responsibilities they may have?
Highly variable. I can definitely tell you the more moments you pay attention to of the ordinary things you do in your daily life, and the more you take just the ordinary perception of what's going on seriously, the more likely these things are to work out. But it's an incredibly wide range of what it seems to take.
Daniel, is there anything else you want to say today? I know this is an extensive topic. You wrote a fantastic book with all sorts of detailed information in there and what someone might experience with this process. Is there anything else you want to say today about hardcore Dharma?
Good luck. Keep your wits about you. And the brakes on a car are more important than the gas pedal.
Great advice. Daniel, thank you so much for being with me today. It's been a true pleasure once again, and I look forward to more conversations with you in the future.
Thank you. It's been delightful, and thank you for rolling with the technical challenges.
Oh, absolutely. And for those of you listening or watching, thank you for being with us. You are the reason that we are here.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ celebrating his 90th birthday.